experience of his or her own body. Besides, the neurotic process that leads to the first consultation has, as a rule, started much earlier and commonly dealt by the parents with the typical, the boy will grow out of it, which, and also regularly, is followed by the boy growing further into it. These boys arrive with a typical constellation of clinical features that have become prominent over the last few decades, that is, states of anxiety that manifest as hyperactivity and or deficits of attention, the so-called ADHD or attention deficit hyperactivity disorder of the psychiatric jargon, which is, in my experience, and that of many colleagues, they are cases of anxiety hysteria, which may progress or not to becoming phobias. Freud considered the phobia as a moment in the evolution of anxiety hysteria, a nosological term that he coined precisely apropos the case of little Hans. An anxiety hysteria is in our days probably the most common clinical type among neurotics of all ages. The elucidation of its structure and phenomenology, so as anxiety hysteria is in our days probably the most common clinical type among neurotics of all ages, the elucidation of its structure and phenomenology in the light of Lacan's proposals in seminar 16 is of interest that is eminently practical. I refer to the links inside the conceptual trio made of the unconscious, knowledge, and the subject as constituting an original thesis of Lacan. Before Lacan, there were very pertinent intuitions, not only by Freud, but also by other analysts on the conception of the unconscious as being knowledge without a subject. In some cases, they are more than intuitions. For example, in the theoretical formulations of Wilfred Bion, whose approach was nevertheless very different from Lacan's perspective. Lacan's thesis is original in that his work has unveiled the structural and functional complexity of the links between the unconscious, knowledge, and the subject, on the one hand, and on the other hand, firstly, the field of jouissance, secondly, the central structuring function of lack and the law of castration, thirdly, the mechanisms of the drive and of desire, in the fourth place, the status of truth, and finally, the properties of the signifier, thinking, perception, grammar, and logic as supports and instruments of human knowledge. This enumeration does not attempt to be exhaustive. It is quite vast anyway, and it does not need to be organized in the clusters into which I have arranged them. Other conceptual links can be found if one reads the text again or from a different angle. Lacan established the unconscious as one of the fundamental, foundational concepts of psychoanalysis. He continued to work on this concept throughout his life and did not attempt to propose a final definition for it. He left it as a field of inquiry about which quite a few things are known and are well established by now. Yet, consonant with its very real, I underline the term real, nature, the unconscious is a field still enigmatic and full of conceptual gaps for us. This is even more the case with knowledge and the subject, whose rationale cannot be encapsulated in circumscribed definitions. In seminar 16, both terms are examined from perspectives that are not necessarily inconsistent, but different in their argument, that is, knowledge and the subject from the viewpoint of topological and algebraic models, and then in association to the series of questions that I have just mentioned, but outside the mathematical models. Knowledge and the subject are heterogeneous, not unified fields of inquiry, as the concept of the unconscious itself is. We cannot expect to have a comprehensive, consistent and complete theory of any of them at least for the time being. The case of Little Hans is paradigmatic in that it vividly presents the struggles of a young human being who attempts to construct theories that give some account of the first major questions that the parlettre, a speaking being, faces in life, namely, the questions arising from the differences between the sexes, the origins of babies, and the parents' engagement in sexual intercourse. These questions and the child's responses to them are formative and become permanent inscriptions in the unconscious. This is solid knowledge, not logically or empirically solid knowledge, but knowledge that we can call tendentious, knowledge conjoined with desire, its representations becoming sites of jouissance in the unconscious. As Freud puts it in his article on the sexual theories of children, and I quote, "A knowledge of infantile sexual theories in the shapes they assume in the thoughts of children can be of interest in various ways, even surprisingly enough, for the elucidation of myths and fairy tales. They are indispensable, moreover, for an understanding of the neuroses themselves. For in them, these childish theories are still operative and acquire a determining influence upon the form taken by the symptoms." That's Freud. So, no matter how clever they may become later in life, as far as their artistic and professional talents are concerned, on those questions that involve elementary sexual matters, adult neurotics, qua neurotics, and qua singular individuals that must face the reality of those questions in their actual experience, they do not surpass children in their theoretical achievements. As theoreticians, children can be original and creative, but like all theoreticians, they are immersed in ordinary discourse, which provides them with their intellectual instruments, that is, language, its grammar, its logic, and its pragmatics. Little Hans appears in two papers prior to his case history in the works of Freud. The two papers are The Sexual Enlightenment of Children of 1907 and The Sexual Theories of Children of 1908, which is the year when the treatment of Hans took place. The case history was published a year later and discussed at the Vienna Psychoanalytic Society that year too, which you find in the minutes of the Vienna Psychoanalytic Society, which are very interesting texts that reflect the golden age of psychoanalysis, in a sense, the moment of creation of psychoanalysis. Both papers, the ones I just mentioned, concern unconscious knowledge and desire and their symptomatic manifestations in the child's dealings with adults. Hans, his father reports, was not quite three and already showed, I quote, a quite peculiarly lively interest in that portion of his body that he used to describe as his widler. That's the Strachey's translation. The original Freudian term is Vivimacher, which means approximately the same as widler, but literally making the thing that makes urine. Once he asked his mother, Hans, and I quote from Freud's text, this time the case history. Hans says, "Mommy, have you got a widler too?" And the mother responds, "Of course, why?" she asked. Hans, "I was only just thinking." That's Freud. He was only just thinking. In chapter 16 of the seminar From One Other to the Other, Lacan discusses the relation between thinking and censorship. This relation is more profound than when censorship is reduced to being the well-known suppression of verbal expression based on prejudices, shame, or social considerations in ordinary life. censorship is grounded in a fundamental, Lacan proposes, I do not know, rather than you should not know or you should not say that. Lacan regards this I do not know as the creative failure of knowledge. Creative failure of knowledge, he says, which is, I quote, the original point of the desire to know, whereby knowledge itself is, I quote again, condemned never to be in a way anything but the correlate of this failure. Knowledge is condemned never to be in a way anything but this correlate of this failure in knowledge. He also says, and I quote Lacan, Seminar 16, page 274 of the French edition, 267 of Cormac Gallagher's version. Lacan says, the Freudian trauma is an I do not know, itself unthinkable since it supposes an I think, dismantled of all thinking. The point of origin, not to be understood developmentally, but structurally, when it is a matter of understanding the unconscious, is that it is in this nodal point of a failing knowledge that there is born what can be called, on condition that you put the last two words in a sort of parenthesis, the desire to know. Desire, brackets, to know, brackets. This is simply unconscious desire in its structure. The desire to know is simply unconscious desire in its structure. That's Lacan. To continue with Little Hans, on the question of the origins and the birth of babies, Hans' parents found no better explanation to give him than the fable of the stork, which Freud explains is common in the German cultural tradition. Now, these parents are parents from whom Freud regards, in his paper on the sexual enlightenment of children, as being understanding parents who, I quote him, abstain from forcibly suppressing one part of the child's development, and who, being among his closest adherents, I quote Freud again in his qualification of these parents had agreed that in bringing up their first child, they would use no more coercion than might be absolutely necessary for maintaining good behavior. So the child, well, Freud says, the child developed into a cheerful, good-natured, and lively little boy. That was Freud. Now, I must say that for all the advances in education that have taken place since the treatment of Little Hans, which happened 112 years ago, our experience shows, my experience and that of many colleagues, I think, our experience shows that parents continue to find it very difficult to answer their children's questions on sexual matters in a rational way. What they say may now be informed by modern developments in science, in biology, in sexology, and also in psychoanalysis. But it remains that the child's questions on sexual matters does not really reflect what his or her actual words say. The child, prompted by his or her own desire, wants to know a bit more about the mother's and the father's desire on those matters, as well as his or her own position regarding those desires. The child's questions are addressed to the core of the parent's being, and on this, science has little to say, even if what it has to say is of interest to us. The stork fable, as Freud indicates, is not one of the sexual theories of children. I quote Freud. Children, Freud argues, refuse to believe the stork theory, and from the time of this first deception and rebuff, they nourish a distrust of adults and have a suspicion of there being something forbidden, which is being withheld from them by the grown-ups, and that they consequently hide their further researches under a cloak of secrecy. With this, however, Freud continues, with this, however, the child also experiences the first occasion for a psychical conflict, in that views for which he feels an instinctual kind of preference, but which are not right in the eyes of the grown-ups, come into opposition with other views, which are supported by the authority of the grown-ups, without being acceptable to him himself. Such a psychical conflict may soon turn into a psychical dissociation. The set of views which are bound up with being good, but also with a cessation of reflection, become the dominant unconscious views. While the other set, for which the child work of research has meanwhile obtained fresh evidence, but which are not supposed to count, become the suppressed and unconscious ones. The nuclear complex of a neurosis is in this way brought into being. That's Freud. So this is how Freud reconstructs, how he imagines, the thinking of little Hans when given the parental, infantile, and infantilizing explanations of the stork. Freud says, imagining what Hans thinks, it was as much as to say, if you really expect me to believe that the stork brought Hannah, the little sister, that is important in the onset of the neurosis, if you really expect me to believe that the stork brought Hannah in October, when even in the summer, while we were traveling to Munden, place of holidays, I noticed how big mother's stomach was, then I expect you to believe my lies. This is how Freud imagines Hans thought. Then, actually, Hans said to his father, I quote from the case history, Hannah just came. Frau Kraus, the midwife, put her in the bed. She couldn't walk, of course, but the stork carried her in her beak. It was the middle of the night, and then the stork put her in the bed very quietly. He didn't trample about at all. And then he took his hat and went away again. No, he hadn't got a hat, the stork. That's Hans. In a condensed paragraph, 10 years before seminar 16, in the instance of the letter in the unconscious or reason since Freud, Lacan had written, I quote, little Hans, left in the lurch at the age of 5 by the failings of his symbolic entourage and faced with the suddenly actualized enigma to him of his sex and his existence, the enigma of his sex and his existence, develops under the direction of Freud and his father, who is Freud's disciple, all the possible permutations of a limited number of signifiers in the form of a myth around the signifying crystal of his phobia. The signifying crystal of his phobia. That's Lacan, you see it. You find in the ECRI, page 432 of the English version of the ECRI. Little Hans is left in the lurch, not only by the infantile sexual theories of his parents, but more significantly by the unhappiness in the relation, the lack of sexual satisfaction in his mother, and the insufficiency of the word of his father as incarnation of the law. All ingredients of the boy's drama, extensively studied by Lacan in his seminar on the object relation, seminar 4, that is. Lacan condenses quite a few theses in that sentence of the instance of the letter, which I think transcend the case of little Hans as of general value. Quite a few theses are there. First, the etiological constellation that leads to the neurotic conflict. Secondly, the transitory resolution of this conflict by means of the institution of the phobia. Thirdly, the epistemic, if you allow me the expression, the epistemic path chosen by the boy to produce what Lacan calls the signifying crystal of his phobia. And fourthly, the part played by the analysis and the establishment of a transcendent relation in the evolution and dissolution of the phobia, even if this outcome was not satisfactory and had the status of a substitutive neurotic construction. The transcendent relation enhanced treatment included the officially designated analyst, the father, whom Freud appointed as the official analyst. This is the father, analyst, supposedly, the professor, that is Freud, in the capacity of subject supposed to know. And then God himself, the true and real subject supposed to know according to Hans, as according to him, the professor knew about the origins of his malaise from his conversations with God. In the seminar, Lacan also refers to God, in the seminar 16, Lacan also refers to God as the ultimate subject supposed to know. And that's for everyone, not just for little Hans. Freud wrote in the case history that his one interpretation to Hans in the case read like this. I summarize it. Long before he was in the world, Freud told Hans, I had known that the little Hans would come who would be so fond of his mother that he would be bound to feel afraid of his father because of it. And I told his father this. And then Hans, on the way home, asked his father, does the professor talk to God? Hans asked his father on the way home, as he can tell all that beforehand. So it was a peculiar transferential arrangement that inaugurated the practice of psychoanalysis with children. I leave aside all the discussion that Lacan introduces in his fourth seminar on the object relation about the validity of this interpretation that he rejects, Lacan or Freud, because there is no trace, if you read the case history carefully, there is no trace of the fear of the father that Freud mentions in his interpretation. And that is why, precisely because of that, Hans has to construct an institution, the phobia, which is something to fear from. In relation to the links between the unconscious, knowledge, and the subject, the institution of the phobia appears as a complex, convoluted, yet vigorous attempt to produce a suppletion, a compensation for the failure in the transmission of the law of castration and the symbolic and imaginary inscriptions of a subjective position that accommodates itself to the phallic signifier as the missing signifier, as Lacan calls this phallic signifier, the missing signifier. Now, there are several possible subjective positions other than a phobia, of course, even if there is a moment in anyone's life when there is vacillation and anxiety in relation to that missing signifier. So that clinically, I think it's evident that it is a normal period in the life of anyone, not necessarily a neurotic. There is a normal period of a phobic neurosis in the life of anyone, which may take a few weeks or a few months in favorable cases. In some other cases, it persists for life, but in most cases, not probably, in which this transitional being left in the lurch by the symbolic environment affects everyone, and each one has to find a way to solve it. On this missing signifier, says Lacan in seminar 16, page 320 of the French version, 326 of Cormac Gallagher's version. Lacan says, I'm going to quote him, it's a bit long, but he says things much better than I could put them to you in a paraphrase. So He says, we cannot start from any trace to ground the signifier of the sexual relation. Everything is reduced to this signifier, the phallus, which is not in the system of the subject, since it is not the subject that it represents. The phallus does not represent the subject, but as one might say, sexual enjoyment, jouissance, sexual jouissance. Qua outside the system, sexual enjoyment as being outside the system, namely absolute, absolute. He takes whatever is outside the system of the order of the symbolicity acquires the status of being absolute, which means detached, not relative to. So then Lacan continues. Sexual enjoyment, sexual jouissance, insofar as it has this privilege as compared to all others, the fact is that something in the pleasure principle that we know constitutes a barrier to enjoyment, to jouissance, the fact is that something in the pleasure principle allows it access all the same, but it is not in this system of the subject. There is no subject of sexual enjoyment, which is the correlative assertion or thesis, correlative to an unconscious knowledge without subject. The phallus, then Lacan says, is the phallus as missing signifier is the signifier outside the system. And in a word, the conventional one to designate what is involved in sexual enjoyment as radically foreclosed. If I spoke about foreclosure quite rightly to designate certain effects of the symbolic relation, it is here that it must be seen that the point must be designated where it cannot be revised. Foreclosure, or the foreclosure of jouissance at large, not simply the foreclosure of the name of the father as in the psychosis, but foreclosure at large, foreclosure of jouissance, normally, let's say. And Lacan continues, if I add that everything that is repressed in the symbolic reappears in the real, it is because jouissance is quite real. The fact is that in the system of the subject, it is nowhere symbolized, nor can it be symbolized. The phallic function seems, by not representing the subject, to mark nevertheless a point of his determination as a field limited by a relationship to what is structured as other, big other. That's Lacan. It is an effect of this foreclosure of jouissance outside of the field of the psychosis proper that some of the clinical manifestations of a phobia may resemble a psychosis. That is, quasi-delusional and quasi-hallucinatory experiences of which the patient gives testimony. It is the subject's entry into the system instituted by the law of castration that the missing signifier ceases to intrude into the subject's life, incarnated this intrusion as a devouring and threatening creature. A patient of mine, afflicted by what he presented as a phobia with intense panic to flying in airplanes, told me that he was convinced not that the airplane would fall down, but that he would die for inexplicable reasons inside the airplane, whether flying or on the ground. He regarded his conviction as nonsensical, but was for years unable to board the plane. The presentation of the phobia, its clinical picture, as it is usually called in the psychiatric jargon, is deceptive as to what really constitutes the phobic object. In fact, this phobic object is not an object, but, as Lacan puts it, a signifying crystal, open to displacements and different interpretations based on the actual experiences of discourse in the life of the patient. A much younger patient, 8 years of age, developed a phobia that concerned a number of meteorological phenomena, in particular tornadoes and electrical storms. He could telephone, this was before internet and online services, I must say, he would telephone the Australian Bureau of Meteorology's automated messages with the weather forecast. But not satisfied with that information, he would ring an officer of the Bureau demanding more precise details. And he was not satisfied with the officer's answers either. When I expressed my skepticism regarding tornadoes in Melbourne, as I had not heard of any in all my years in the city, he told me, "Ah, you will see." Shortly after that, there was a tornado in Queensland, a few thousand kilometers away. And he triumphantly said to me, "Do you see? They are coming, they are coming." In both cases, the phobias disappear as soon as the underlying sources of the acute castration complex were elucidated, but the neurosis remained. Lacan regarded the phobia not at all as a clinical entity, but as a sort of turntable. I quote, it is by, I quote Lacan also in seminar 16, page 307 of the French edition is in chapter 19. It is by elucidating its relationships with what it most commonly veers towards, namely the two great orders of neurosis, hysteria and obsessional neurosis, but also with the junction that it realizes with the structure of perversion, that this phobia enlightens us about what is involved in all sorts of consequences that have no need to be limited to a particular subject to be perfectly perceptible, Freud, Lacan says. Now, on the connections between phobia and the other neuroses and phobia and the perversions, apart from the already mentioned text by Helene Deutsch, I must refer to the paper by Hans Sachs on the origin of perversions, also quoted by Lacan in other contexts. Sachs' article contains very interesting clinical cases that illustrate the oscillation between perversion and phobia in some subjects. There is also a relevant paper by Freud himself, published in the minutes of the Vienna Psychoanalytic Society, that discusses a case of foot fetishism with a history of phobia. In seminar 16, Lacan proceeds with his elucidation of the subjective position of little Hans and beyond. He says, the turning point from which the birth of a neurosis emerges is what? It is the positive intrusion of an autoerotic enjoyment that is perfectly typified in what are called the first sensations, more or less linked to onanism, however you want to describe it, in the child, that is masturbation. Lacan continues, it is thanks to the positive relation, to the enjoyment described as sexual, but without, for all that, the sexual conjunction being in any way assured, the sexual conjunction, the sexual relation or rapport being in any way assured, and this is a precursor, I think, of the developments of the thesis on the lack of proportion between the sexes and the sexuality of women in seminars 19, 20, and the following seminars, and also in this seminar 16 itself later on in the text. It is thanks to this positive relation that then Lacan says that something is designated as essential for the position of the subject. It is the desire to know. The decisive step taken by Freud about the relation of sexual curiosity to the whole order of knowledge is the essential point of the psychoanalytic discovery, he says. And Lacan then says, it is in as far as something is produced that I call drama, that the significance of the other qua is structured and hold, structured but with holes, is something different to what we can call metaphorically the signifier that holds it, namely the phallus. It is in so far as it is different that we see what happens when the young subject has to respond to what is produced by the intrusion of the sexual function into his subjective field. That's Lacan. Lacan describes with precision the set of signifiers that Little Hans employs to attempt to resolve the impasse in which he finds himself to be when faced with the problem of sexual difference and his own sexed position. He refers to the game that Little Hans indulges in, which involves a confrontation between the big giraffe and the small giraffe. Lacan says that, "I was able to underline the importance by showing what the phobia reveals at its foundation, namely, the impossibility of making the Hommel, it's a H-O-M-M-E-L-L-E, it's a neologism by Lacan, the Hommel, that is condensing om and female, Hommel, namely, he says, this phallic mother, which is the relationship that Hans expresses in the big giraffe. How these coexist, on the other hand, anything whatsoever that might reduce it. If he draws the little giraffe, it is clearly to show not that it is an image comparable to the other, but it is a writing on a sheet of paper. And for that reason, Lacan employs the German term used by Freud, Servurzelt it, that is, as it is put in the text, he crumples it up and sits on it. Hans does that. That's Lacan. Now, little Hans is a neurotic with a difference. He does not complain much. He prefers to research and to find solutions, precarious and fictional as they might be, neurotic solutions. He knows that he has to find a way to deal with the unconscious, with what he does not know, and with what he knows, and with his position as a subject in the human world. He knows that he has to deal with all those things. And he knows that he must face the obstacles, both surmountable and impossible to surmount, that he finds in his path. He's a good analysand, as Freud points out, with an excellent intuitive grasp of psychoanalysis. I refer to a footnote that Freud introduces in the case history. His case continues to be inspirational to us. Certainly, a phobia is not as such inspirational, yet it is very instructive as to some of the ways in which the unconscious and knowledge determine what a subject as a speaking being comes to be. Thank you.
Thank you, Leonardo. That was very interesting. Sorry, I've just done something to my technology. So I have a very quick presentation and then we can open the floor to discussion. Don't forget, please, to go into your participants tab down the bottom. And if you would like to contribute to the discussion, please press the raise hand button and I'll keep a running list of who has something to say. So my name is Nicole Thomas. I am a member of the School of the International Forums of the School of Psychoanalysis of the Forums of the Lacanian Field. I'm a member of the Forum of Melbourne. I'm your current representative of the Anglophone Zone of the International Forums. And I'm also a psychoanalyst who practices in Melbourne. I just have a very brief contribution, and it comes in the form of a clinical vignette. My analysand, a former addict, is remembering a time when he is in rehab, how he had been suffering withdrawals. A psychologist, who he remembers was a Freudian and who was working with him at the time, some 20-odd years ago, came to see him while he was in the rehab facility. My analysand's recollection is that within a few moments of speaking with him, the psychologist identified that he was in withdrawal and what he was in withdrawal from. The psychologist picked it up immediately without him having to say anything about it. As I listen to my analysand, I register something. Here is an accusation towards me, the analyst in the room with him. You haven't told me what is wrong with me yet. You, the analyst, are not doing your job. You are not fulfilling your place as subject supposed to know. What's wrong with me? Give me the answer. Reveal to me my guilt. I make a cut here and I ask him, what is it you want me to pick up? He has to work now. He has to say the words. He says, I'm craving the substance again. He associates further to pleasure, jouissance, and the resistance to castration in the face of the fantasy of unlimited gratification. He has to work on picking it up himself. His demand, pick up what I'm not telling you about myself, covers up something of the horror that occurs for him in the knowledge, I have to pick up on myself, I have to pick myself up. To him, my failure is that I haven't picked it up like his former Freudian. To me, my lack in picking it up, but picking up that I haven't picked it up, puts him to work, and we arrive at his fantasy of unlimited gratification and the horror of castration. There are several levels of the meaning in the phrase picking up to pick up. Number one, I pick it up. I find something hidden in the meaning. I understand something I didn't know before. Number two, pick yourself up is a demand. Do better, work harder. It's a recovery of failure. Number three, a pick me up, a tonic or substance to elevate the mood after exhaustion, depression, a hangover. And number four, pick her or him up. It's a seduction, someone for a usually quick sexual encounter. All variations of the pickup indicate some work, an action upon a realization of a lack. I wonder if something of my analysand's unconscious knowledge surfaced in this moment of his own horror at the castration that he has to pick himself up and work that is entailed there for him. He prefers not to know so far, to believe in the fantasy that unlimited gratification exists in both the pick-me-up, the substance, and the pick her up, that his work is in, I pick up, that I have to pick myself up. So he demands that I, his analyst, picks up what he is doing, fantasizing about the substance that he wants to bring him unlimited gratification and to forget his own castration. But he knows that this substance brings jouissance, the tickle that ends in a blaze of petrol, as Lacan says. He wants the other to firstly pick up on the jouissance, then to do the work of castration or perhaps even collusion. Many of his dreams speak to a castration that is not so bad, not painful, benign. There is a horror for him in the endless castrations of quotidian life. He retreats from this, putting great distances between himself and the work of daily life. What is it then that came in for me in the knowing that I lacked in the moment? He accuses me of not picking him up. It was a moment that I picked something up, but not in the way as my analysand wanted. In the analyst's discourse, I stand in as a semblant of the petty objet art. I am in the position of the driver of the analysand's desire, but also the waste on which he puts his demand, his accusation. Why don't you know? Why don't you pick it up about me? Why don't you pick me up, he tells me. I utilise my lack, what I don't know about him, and he isn't telling me yet, to put him to work, to associate, to speak of himself, which is precisely another of his horror, to know something of his castration. My not knowing causes a gap for the unconscious to work, to emerge perhaps. I'll finish with a quote from Lacan from Seminar 24, Le Ansu, Qu'est-ce de l'humbez-vous celle à mort, forgive my pronunciation, but roughly translates into English as the unknowing knowledge of the one blunder is winging itself to death. So Lacan says, what is at stake in knowledge in what we call signifier effects? Man scarcely escapes this business of knowledge. This is dictated to him by what I called the signifier effects, and he is not at ease. He does not know how to deal with, faire avec, knowledge, with a big K. I do not accept myself simply because I have to deal with the same material as everyone else, and that this material is what dwells in us. With this material, he does not know how to deal with. It is the same thing as this dealing with that I spoke about just now, but these nuances of the tongue are very important. This effet, to deal with, cannot be said in every language. Knowing how to deal with is something different to know how. It means to get on with it. But this deal with indicates that one does not really capture the thing, in short, in a concept. Thank you. Let's open the floor for discussion. Questions, comments? Leonardo gave us a very, very thorough, a very detailed and interesting discussion. Any questions arising from that? Macario.
Leonardo, could you say a bit more? I think it's a very important, one of the many things that you said, the question of censorship. I do not know as the creative failure of knowledge. So the I do not know as hiding thinking, right? Could you expand a little bit more on that central concept that you were explaining to us?
Yeah, thank you for the question. It's important. Lacan's idea is that thinking acts as censorship. And that is why I think the editor of the seminar in the French official, let's say, version has called that chapter in which the question is discussed, which is chapter 17.
Uh-huh.
He has entitled it, Jacques Alain Miller did this, Pensée censure, thinking or thought censorship, thinking censorship. Mm-hmm. That is the function of censorship of thinking, of any thinking, because any thinking hides thinking. Mm-hmm. There is a notion that the epistemologist, that I think has an influence on Lacan's work, at least initially, Gaston Bachelard coined the notion of epistemological obstacle. What is the typical epistemological obstacle? A piece of knowledge. A piece of knowledge acts up as a prejudice against further knowledge. And as we see in the case of Little Hans, a piece of knowledge, the incentive to create pieces of knowledge, to think, in other words, is to fill in some gaps in knowledge, gaps created by the experience in the world, an experience of jouissance, of trying to have a good time in this world as best as one can, because that is impossible. One fabricates knowledge, no? But all our knowledge is a fabrication of some kind. But and as such, even the best possible knowledge, we aim at that to an extent ourselves with our limited means. Even the best possible knowledge is going to have gaps. And that means that whatever comes to fill in those gaps with very good intentions on the parts of the thinker, on the part of the thinker, on our own dealing side with our own gaps in knowledge, has an effect of censorship, because there is a dual aim, let's say, of producing further knowledge, but also of filling in the of healing in, covering up the gaps. That's the idea. It's not only Little Hans that shows with his fabrications that he's covering up gaps in his knowledge, because his parents are in the same boat. They are doing the same when they provide him with false theories. And now, in our enlightened age, let's say, parents provide with apparently better theories that usually refers to the findings of science, and they tell, for example, that sexuality is quite a natural thing. Well, there is nothing much natural about human sexuality, really. That's the problem. And the child knows that. He knows that the other is not only his own knowledge that fades, the other knowledge fades, and that he has to cover the gaps. And that knowledge, therefore, a distrust in knowledge is created in everyone. Now, it can take a healthy form, let's say, or the form of a cynical skepticism that we prefer not to embark into.
Thank you, Leonardo. Yeah. If I may add the last thing, I was it was very interesting what you said at the beginning, basically that we still don't, we know a lot as to what the unconscious is, but we still don't know enough about what the unconscious is.
Yeah. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Well, that we in Melbourne have to get up at 4 o'clock in the morning to to have a discussion with you on the other side of the world is a proof of that. We don't know really much of the unconscious.
Serena.
Can you hear me, Nikki?
Yes.
Yes, okay, sorry. And I'm sorry I couldn't present this morning, but I just didn't have time to do it in the way that I wanted to. But one of the things I was going to explore was this, that there's something typical in our practice about in these moments of blind spots, and that I think is a moment that Leonardo is talking about when he speaks about this idea of not, it's almost like the subject has to catch up to their unconscious in a sense in the work through the process of deciphering. But I've noticed these blind spots appear often where there's quite a positive identification with whatever is at stake in the jouissance, or it's a position that has supported certain ideals of the subjects. They find it much harder to see the jouissance that is at work in those experiences as well. That idea of and then the work, it needs to be addressed to an analyst, because the work of deciphering is what provides, I suppose, some possibility of knowledge of one's unconscious through that process. But I was interested, Leonardo, as your comment of the sexual jouissance always being on the outside, always being in that domain of the real, so that, and that is that that appears in these enigmatic effects of the symptom, that appears in these blind spots of a person, you know, when a person has an investment in some sort of ideal, a heroic sacrificial ideal. I had an obsessional man who was very fond of this ideal and found it very difficult to see that there was any, to explore the jouissance state, that it was almost, even though he could understand the structure of his fantasy and he could explore the way in which the enjoyment in that passive position for him, it was much more difficult to see for him to identify how that his what he had always built up as a sort of fundamental part of himself, a really positive identification of this sacrificing and going beyond, over and above. These were all things that he had built a favourable sense of himself on, and that was really a difficult, what was most difficult in the work was for him to see the way in which that too was part of his jouissance, this sexuality, this enjoyment, and fed that. So could you comment a bit more on that idea of the sexual jouissance being always outside, as you were quoting Lacan, but your own reflections on that?
There is quite a bit in that question, because, okay, the sexual jouissance is outside representation. I mean, the best part of it is outside the representation, because representation, either symbolic representation or imaginary representation, or let us say, perhaps it's better to speak of imaginary presentation of jouissance, they are not simply representations, that is, things of a different quality to jouissance, because there is jouissance in the signifier itself, there is jouissance in the image itself, but there is jouissance, I'm calling it the best part of it, which is outside representation, either signifying representation or imaginary representation. And that is precisely what makes it attractive, no? And is precisely what makes it attractive and what terrifies the human subject, both things. That is outside representation, because being outside representation, one gets the impression, which is not always well-founded, the impression that one has no control over it. No? Well, one is precisely attracted to that, not being able to control it. And yet, of course, is terrified of it. Each one has to find, as Freud says, quoting the Emperor, or each one has to find his own path to salvation. Each one has to find his own path to jouissance.
Sarah, I think you had a question.
Yes, I do have a question. Thank you very much for your presentations. I have a question to Leonardo. Thank you for your wonderful paper. And I also have a question to Unical. So you said something interesting, very interesting, that caught my attention. And I wonder, perhaps this would follow well with the remark that was just being made about knowledge. I believe I heard that you said we suffer from what we don't know, but we also suffer from what we know. Would it be possible for you to say a bit more about the ways in which we suffer from knowledge? How could you develop that? Perhaps it is also useful. Maybe at this point in the discussion, I thought of it while listening to you, to make the differentiation between knowledge and truth. Yes. Perhaps this is a useful point to remember about. I think this was very clear in your presentation, but I am interested in this aspect of, or possibility of, actually suffering from knowledge. And I have a question for Nicole, what you said towards the very end of your presentation, when you evoked the French formulation of savoir y faire, knowing how to deal with something, and you said very, very rightly, I believe, that dealing with something does not have to mean that we actually grasp what it is that we are exactly dealing with. So it takes us somewhere else than actually knowledge. Well, I think that you used the term of castration with reference to that. With reference to dealing with, I thought that was very interesting, because I'm just so used to hearing the formulation of savoir y faire with the symptom. Mm-hmm. So it's like the symptom that comes in, so the jouissance of the symptom comes in at that point, but you actually chose to evoke castration. I thought that was very interesting. So that's like a question comment.
Leonardo?
Suffering from knowledge. Well, it is a common source of suffering, perhaps more than suffering from ignorance, that in many respects is taken to be bliss, no? Suffering from ignorance. But say Oedipus, poor Oedipus. His problems started when he started to know, not while he remained ignorant. Little Hans too suffered from what he knows, because the stories that the parents tell him do not convince him. And then there are the stories that the parents do not tell him at all, but he knows something about that, even if he doesn't know much. But he knows enough to see that the mother and the father are unhappy with each other. And that affects him directly. In that sense, that is, that one suffers from what one knows. What Freud called resistance, after all, applies mostly to that knowledge that one has and does not want to recognize. No? Now, the interesting thing is that knowledge that one has and does not want to recognize cover up that fundamental I do not know that Lacan refers to. That is the true, let's say, unconscious knowledge without the subject. Behind what the subject can recognize as being of himself and pertaining intimately to himself, there is something that concerns him, no doubt, because it's not that it it is it concerns someone else. Hmm? Because unconscious knowledge without subject does not mean that the unconscious does not affect the subject. On the contrary, this affects the subject. This knowledge that does not have a subject affects nevertheless the subject in the most intimate way. And the problem is to get to know a bit of it. That Lacan, I think, assimilates to truth, to the position of truth. So knowledge goes towards truth, never quite reaching it. No, there is a distance between the two. But all knowledge has a truth as its aim, without ever achieving it, as it were.
Maybe this is the moment with the term of recognition, as in recognizing, becomes useful, right? Because if there is something that I do not know, and I cannot know, but it concerns me in the most intimate way, the least I can do is try to recognize that it does concern me. This maybe it's different than gaining a knowledge about it, but that's very interesting. Thank you.
So just to make a little bit of headway on your question to direct to me, Sarah, I suspect that in the vignette that I gave, the symptom has got to do a lot with the horror of the knowledge. Okay, there is something, I think there is something that needs to be done with this horror of knowledge as symptomatic. So that's I think, why I bring in the castration, because this idea that there is an unlimited jouissance and gratification that castration needs to act upon is precisely the core of what's going on. This is perhaps the knowledge, but I think what I was trying to demonstrate was that, yes, okay, he knows that, I know that, but there was something else happening in that particular moment to do with a signifier pickup that I didn't pick up, okay? So I think I was trying to demonstrate really this idea of, as you said, we don't grasp, or we can't grasp what's going on, and it goes elsewhere. So I found that moment was an opportunity somehow to use that going elsewhere precisely to address what needed to be addressed in the symptom. So I think that's where I was going with that, yeah. Mm-hmm. Gabriella. Gabriella had a question. Costardi.
Okay, yes. I want to thank you, both of you, for your presentations. And I have a follow-up on the Leonardo's answer to Serena's question. So Leonardo, I found very interesting the quote by Lacan about the phallic signifier not representing the subject, but enjoyment, sexual enjoyment. And so I was kind of trying to understand what that meant, what that means. And but honestly, when you explained, I think I missed something, or I missed even more than I was missing before, because if he connects the phallic signifier to jouissance, to representing jouissance, so I was understanding that what is not represented is the subject. So it's a type of knowledge that does not represent the subject. But still, there is some type of function of representation going on in regards to pleasure, because it's about a signifier. However, when you were following up on that, I understood you were saying that's completely outside of any type of representative function. So I don't know if I got it correctly, but I was then thinking, what is the phallic signifier doing here? What type of knowledge is this one? Because he's not talking about a leather or a trait or whatever other types of marks, but a phallic, it's a signifier in any case. So I was basically trying to get through that, if you can pick it up, maybe.
Okay. Can I say something then? It's a very complex question that you pose, Gabriela, but okay. I think it can be tackled in what I know from a number of angles. If you refer to Lacan's seminal text on the phallus as a signifier, the signification of the phallus, there he defines the phallus as the signifier that designates as a whole the field of the signified, the field of the signified. Now, he also spoke of the phallus as the signifier, we could say, with which the subject identifies, say in the seminars 4, 5, when he comes to the world, he's the phallus of the mother and he identifies with that. Apparently, that phallus represents the subject. But that, I think, is a different definition, which is in tension with the idea of the phallus representing the field of the signified as a whole. What he says here in seminar 16 is that the phallus, which is a signifier, is missing in the sense that the subject is not represented by it, and yet it affects the subject. But the subject is not represented by it in the sense of not being the phallus, of not representing the subject as phallus, which is in a sense also contained already in the first formulation of the phallus of, say, in seminar 5, when he discusses the progression of the paternal metaphor, how one starts in life as being the phallus of the mother, that is to say, being identified with the phallic representative, the phallic signifier, and yet knowing very well, it's not the child who knows it to begin with, but he'll get to know it soon enough, that he's not the phallus. That he cannot be identified with the phallus, that he's destined to be de-phallicized, that is to say, to be castrated in the sense of abiding the law of castration. That is how I understand it. In that sense, the phallus cannot represent the subject, but it represents a kind of compass, the point of reference to which the subject has to accommodate, even if it is not complete. As discussed by Lacan later on in with the thesis of sexuation. The phallus divides the world into two, as it were, phallic and not phallic, in the sense of not determined exclusively by the phallus, but is still a point of reference to which everybody has to somehow accommodate. Mm-hmm. But it does not represent the subject, in the sense no subject can say, this is my proper name. I wanted to say something in relation to the previous question by Sarah on suffering from what one knows. Well, look, in this relation between knowledge and the unconscious, not everything is on the side of the pathological, I would say. Not everything is on the side of the pathological because, and I think a good illustration of that is Freud's book on jokes. There you have, in the experience of any human subject, the sudden eruption of a signifier, a piece of knowledge that is completely unexpected, surprising to the subject. The subject is captured off guard, as it were, and brings quite a response of jouissance in him, which we cannot say is pathological. The joke is the only one of the formations of the unconscious that is social, is socially grounded. It requires a social partnership. Otherwise, it doesn't work as a joke. Here, I think you have a piece of knowledge which does not have a subject, but which affects the subject in the sense of suddenly being introduced into his life. It's an intrusion of jouissance, which is transient, transitory, but beneficial, let's say. The opposite of anxiety.
Transient and transmissible as well. Just like Great, yeah, thank you.
Gary. I'm happy. Gary, you had a question.
I was doing my usual niggle about the way we throw the term subject around. And interestingly enough, because it's in a piece we're dealing with about unconsciousness, knowledge without a subject. And it strikes me that, you know, the four discourses aren't like an academic typology of discourse, because one can produce discourse in other senses as well, but they're like a provocative effect of psychoanalysis. Psychoanalysis produces those discourses. And in them, the subject is produced as a barred subject. It's not, you know what I mean? Like the subject in a way is, or else is, as it were, in that formula, you know, like a knowledge without a subject. You know, like we, in the psychoanalysis, do we actually encounter the subject? The effects of psychoanalysis is to the production of this barred subject. And it strikes me that this constant appeal to the subject is in a way a little problematic, but, you know, like the anyway, that was my initial thought. And part of the interesting thing is like this idea of representation having something that being knowledge, but in a way we could understand it as actually, as I think Leonardo was hinting a bit, that it's actually the censorship of knowledge. It's the it's the array, funnily enough, all those marks are an erasure of knowledge. And strangely enough, it's the roboticists who articulate it the best. And early on in the piece, when they rejected symbolic logic, you know, like that you produce computer systems that, you know, would analyze the environment. Okay, I'm going to walk over here. But they were completely paralyzed with this model of consciousness, because they'd see a shadow and they'd say, was that an object or a shadow? And they'd end up going through these loops and couldn't move. So they devised this schema around producing like little insects where you had all these simultaneous processes going on. And the opening salvo had this, it's a very witty paper, but its title was fantastic. It was called Intelligence Without Representation. You know, the problem is that symbolic representation is not knowledge, you know what I mean? It's paralysis. But anyway, it was just my ongoing niggle about the way we throw the term subject around. It did seem a little ironic in the, given the nature of the topic we're dealing with. Anyway, Leonardo, maybe.
You raise very difficult questions, Gary, as usual, but we know Gary in Melbourne, of course. One point, yes, the question of representation and presentation. Is all knowledge of the order of representation? That's a question. That is why I say knowledge for us is a field of inquiry. It is not that we have very solid knowledge about knowledge either. We are researching on it. Because we may say that many forms of knowledge are more on the side of being presentations, that is, for example, things that appear for the first time in the life of anyone for which we do not have representation. Is that knowledge or not? I would say it would be difficult to dismiss that as not being knowledge. It is knowledge, no? And even the representation in the form of signifiers, sometime or other are presentations too. As the poet Borges, Jorge Luis Borges, my compatriot, put it, all words were once a neologism. No? all words were neologisms at some point. Because what is a neologism? Something that appears uttered for the first time. And that is an eruption in the field of knowledge, if you wish, in the field of language, which cannot break with the rules of language, but which is a novelty anyway, something new altogether, a presentation in the world of representations. So in analysis that happens, I think, and it happens in the joke too, and it happens with all the formations of the unconscious, that a new reality is presented which breaks with the established representations, even if it's not not determined by the established representations, by language, by the structures of culture, and so on. It's a question to research. Say, the emphasis in Lacan from a conception of the subject as an effect of the signifier, no? Which is present even in the theory of the discourses still, even in this seminar 16. Two, being a parletter, a speaking being, is still a subject, but a subject in a different position, I think, in the theory now, has to do with that too. The fact that no human being, let's say, can be reduced to being a subject, because that would be reduced to being only an entity which is the product of alienation, which is one of the constitutive mechanisms of the formation of the subject, say, in position of the unconscious. That is still valid to an extent, but a subject cannot possibly be only that. A human being cannot be possibly be only that, because there is not much room for any jouissance in that. In the process of an analysis, it is true that there is a progressive dismantling of this subject as subject of alienation, as subject of the signifying chains that have formed him throughout his life, no doubt. The subject is increasingly naked in analysis and reduced to what, being without identifications. That's the ideal in a sense. But what does it mean? This destitution of the subject. Lacan jokes about that in the proposition of 67. Is this something to offer to the world, the destitution of the subject, to make of all our patients destitutes? Is that the idea? No, really. Is to make them a bit more knowledgeable, if you wish, of their jouissance, and also more knowledgeable about the fact that they don't know much. But, that is key to knowledge, and that knowledge acts very well, easily, as censorship. All that.
Yeah, but in a sense that in the discourses, for instance, the subject is barred. In psychoanalytic discourse, the subject is barred. There is a place that it appears, but that place is the gap or the hole. Do you know what I mean? Like, there is a place for the subject, but it's a gap, it's a hole.
Yeah.
You know, like, I mean, you know what I mean? Like, the. Anyway, it just strikes me that there is a bit in the appeal to the subject, there's too much of the appeal to sort of like conscious or representational knowledge. You know, the destitution of the subject, I think we can take quite literally, you know what I mean, in the effect of analysis, in that it's only ever found, it's only ever presumed, as it says, in the gaps, you know, because there is one signifier goes to the next. And we never encounter the subject. There's only this presumption of the subject, but that presumption has an effect, this barred subject. You know what I mean? Like, anyway, I'll leave it there.
Yeah, we need to push on. We've got several questions coming up. Gabriella Zorzutti, you've been waiting very patiently.
Thank you. Thank you both for the presentations. Nicole, I was thinking about this, and then the question of Sarah regarding this deal with equivalent or not to grasping, what is to grasp? To grasp what, no? Because in in the case, it seems at this moment where you don't pick it up, I don't know that you miss something or you abstain properly, no? In the way that what follows is work, and in addition is a way to go into it that is not at all therapeutic. It's straight into analytic effects. And I think this is how, in a way, this heretic practice that some of us they're into in this time and in this culture, whatever cultures these are, remains political. No, this clinic is political, one by one, but political nonetheless. No, this is, I think, the orientation into analytic effects. I was that moment seemed particularly timely for that passage, no, of register things. That was all, and thank you both for an excellent presentation.
Thank you. Look, we've got many questions coming up. I'm going to just push on with the questions. Macario was next. Can you unmute yourself?
I'm sorry.
No, it's all right. Macario, you had a question.
Yes. Do I need to unmute me?
No, you're unmuted now. It's okay.
Okay. Yeah, I still wanted to follow up what Gabriela Costardi asked and what Gary was talking about. Because when we say, or when you say that there is no subject of sexual enjoyment, if we think of the matheme of the fantasy, of course, on the left side, there is the subject of representation. But on the right side, there is the object without representation. But can't we say that a subject is in both sides, even though we tend to associate the word subject only with the subject of representation? But in Seminar 11, when Lacan discusses the forda, he very clearly says, when he's describing the little boy play with the object, he talks so much about how the subject is in that position as well. And so could you clarify more that, because the subject of representation versus the subject that is not represented, but my understanding is that the subject is there even though it's not represented.
Is the question for me?
Yes. Well, for you and for and Nicole too, if you want. Yeah.
The formula of the fantasy is interesting because it concerns the three registers of subjective experience, say symbolic, imaginary, and real.
Right.
The subject as an effect of the imaginary chain, of the signifying chain, say. The real is represented by the object, precisely. The symbolic is also represented by the link between the two, because it's a logical link, represented by the lozenge symbol. And then the imaginary is represented by the whole function of the fantasy in its impact as scenario for desire.
Right.
Now, there is something reductive in considering that the subjects only effects of signifiers. And that is why I think the change of emphasis in the work of Lacan towards the increasing recognition of the real and of jouissance in the life of the subject. Because life is the pertinent word here, because otherwise the subject as pure effect in the signified, of the signifying chain, where is the life of the subject there? It doesn't appear to be registered in the representation, in the discussion, in the conceptual formulation. So this has to be given a place. And we are still dealing with that, because it's not easy to identify the places where the subject appears as a speaking being. That occurs already in the, if one looks at the problem from language itself. One thing is language in its synchronic virtual form. Another thing is language in action, the pragmatics of language, in which the theory of the discourses is Lacan's contribution to it, in a sense. Now, the thing changes if one changes the perspective to putting much more emphasis in the fact that the speaking being speaks, and this speaking is actions, is not only representation, it's also presentation. And it's action in the sense of doing things to another, which is the very idea of discourse, after all. It's what is called the pragmatics of language. All that is deserves attention. It doesn't invalidate what went before, but it has to be made compatible, if it is possible, that they are made compatible.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Mm-hmm. Serena, I think you are next on the list of hands.
Please now?
Serena, you need to unmute yourself.
Sorry. We're back now. Just to say more then, or maybe even to give an example of this way. So if sexual jouissance is always on the outside and this is the real, how does it then appear? Could you sort of give us an example, Leonardo, of this in your clinical work, of the appearance or what one does with this too in an analysis, this outside, what can't be captured entirely by the discourse or where even that can be revealed in some way, this jouissance that's outside. That you named sexual. What creates a whole, I suppose, is what you're saying in the signifying chain, or always appears as a whole. It's not something that can be grasped entirely by the signifier.
Well, let's say in the analytic experience, jouissance is reduced heavily, considerably, to a minimum. It is still present. Because where there is life, human life, there is jouissance, that's for sure. There is a jouissance, a dimension of jouissance in speech itself, in speaking, why not? Even for us analysts, this jouissance is heavily reduced. That is why we shouldn't speak too much, let's say. But it's not only for that reason. We have to let the other, the analysant speak. And in that, he indulges in some jouissance, some of which is good for nothing, as Lacan defined jouissance once. We, without dismissing it, we do not focus on it, let's say. But what we say, our only instrument, our words, have an effect on the jouissance of the patient. That is why he comes to see us, to receive some effect from us, from our action. So, and what we say has an effect. Sometimes it's very intangible, but it tends to have an effect. The patients I mentioned, for example, in telling the story, they were already getting to know a few things that they did not know before. And that, why is it that in the subject who couldn't fly airplanes, all of a sudden, overnight, I would say, He went and bought a ticket and went to Europe without any problem. After what? I didn't have to do much except help him to unravel the story that was behind this phobia to being within a plane. It's not really to flying. The expression is. Deceptive, as it usually is in the description of phobias. I cannot go into the whole story, but it is something that concerns jouissance. And the effect of words on the jouissance, which is a sexual prohibited jouissance, that's what has at stake. Because the point was, what was he going to do? Where was he going to go in that plane. And then by displacement, by contamination of the signifier itself, what was he going to do with any travel by plane? No? It was something of a sexual nature that he himself did not tolerate in himself. He was incompatible with his own principles and with his own modality of jouissance as a whole. It was disruptive of his jouissance. Now, analysis is a treatment of the real by the symbolic, a very broad definition, let's say, because it is by symbolic means that we proceed. But we expect this symbolic means to be, the linguist calls it pragmatics, the pragmatics of language. We expect our symbolic means to have real effects. Otherwise, it's pure blah, blah. And we are not happy with that, with pure blah, blah, no doubt. There is much more to it.
Yeah, we've got a couple more questions. One from Nestor and then Daphne Tamarin. Nestor.
Yes, thank you. Thank you both for your presentations. I wanted to ask Leonardo, regarding, you use the term, you talk about the phallic signification, which goes to the signified, as you said. And then you talk about the sexual jouissance. And what was missing for me in what you said, and maybe I got lost, where is the phallic jouissance here in this in the thing that you present, as you present them? Something is missing for me, because I can link the phallic signification, as you said, with the fantasy, and then in that way with the subject as a cause of itself, if you want, regarding the formula of the object, subject, losange, object A. But when I think about jouissance, like in the case of phobia that you present, well, yeah, you brought us from Freud, but and it's okay, and even also from the object relations from seminar 4. But I'm aware already since seminar 16 about the let's say not Hans erection plays a role, if I understood Lacan and also Colette, plays a role in the overwhelming experience that this child has. So maybe you, of course, you connect the desire of knowledge, the desire to know, you connect it to the desire of the parents to know something about that. And that's how you got to sexual jouissance, if I understood. I was thinking, for me, always when I think about sexual jouissances, I think about sexuated, not about sexual. Like I think of the sexuated formulas, for instance. But if I think about the difference between the phallic signification, so the next one that I know I need to differentiate is the one between the symbolic as the real, as you said, that is what we see in analysis. So it will be there phallic, major fee, phallic jouissance, not phallic signification. They are both exist simultaneously, but I think that you did not differentiate them enough, at least for me, and I couldn't understand this thing at the end when you said that there is a foreclosure of the jouissance. So I don't know if I should understand this, that there is foreclosure of the lack that produced the jouissance, or there is a foreclosure of the jouissance itself. So maybe you can help me to understand a little better this signifiers.
There are quite a few things there, but the expression foreclosure of jouissance is Lacan's. It appears in this chapter 20, I think, is of the seminar. And I think refers to the fact, I think the concept is simple. It may be difficult to extract all the consequences, but that there is a dimension of jouissance that is outside signification, and this outside the symbolic and outside the imaginary, which makes it real. There is real jouissance.
That, and outside the body, you mean outside the body?
Outside the body, if we take the body to be a represented body, a body with an inscription in the symbolic and in the imaginary. But Lacan also refers as jouissance as involving phenomena of the body. So we have to consider that the term body is employed in two different senses, I think, here, related but different. The body as the represented body and the body as the real body. Perhaps the term organism would be better suited to refer to it, but it has its problems too, the term organism. Anyway, you say phallic signification.
Phallic jouissance.
Phallic jouissance. No, but you also
referred to... You said phallic signification. I say yes, right, but then something is missing here.
What is missing is the signifier phallus, according to Lacan, in the symbolic order of the subject. Of the subject, I think, not in the symbolic order in abstract, I think, because it would be, I think, difficult to imagine a signifier which is not present in the symbolic order in abstract, the universal symbolic order, let's say.
What about the symptom? What about the symptom which will be in between the symbolic and the real? There is no necessary representation and not interpretation for such a thing. And it's most of our jouissance is phallic. I understand that there is also phallic signification, as I said, through the fantasy, etc. But if when we talk about symptoms, we talk about phallic jouissance, don't we? Mainly.
Well, that's a question, I think. That's a question. I don't know that all symptoms are the derivatives of phallic jouissance. Because what is phallic jouissance? Is jouissance organized, oriented, regulated by the phallic signifier considered as a rule? As a rule, the phallus, this is what distinguishes Lacan from the rest of psychoanalysis, the phallus is the signifier of castration as law. But
in the field, you mean the big phi, the big phi, major.
Yeah.
That's what you mean.
Yeah, but this, the phallus is minus phi as well, and that represents more emphatically, I think, jouissance regulated by the phallic order,
but by the fantasy, in this case, by the phantasma. Yes.
I don't know about that. I don't know that
because I'm all the time asking you about the other one, not about the one with the phallic signification. I understand. I agree very much with what you said. But in regard, for me, what is missing here is the dimension of the symptom. Of course, there are also symptoms related to the fantasy and the drives. They have fixations, etc., we know. But I think that when we talk about symptoms in general, we are talking about something wider than that. And that's why, for instance, thinking about the erection, Hans erections, it take us differently than trying to understand the desire of the parents in the situation, in the particular situation that he doesn't kiss his wife in breakfast. I think that there is, first of all, this excitement in the penis that he doesn't know how to deal with. And this is what bring him to look at the horse and to bring a signifier that will represent the excitation itself. So,
well, if you look at the case history, the appearance of the erection is not necessarily something traumatic for little Hans. He's quite happy with his erections until the phallic signification of his penis arrives in his life. That complicates his existence, because until then, his penis was quite all right.
Yes, I'm aware that Lacan even said that he would be a pervert heterosexual or something like that, that he will grow to be something like that. But I understand that he's playing a lot with the girls in infancy, but I'm talking about the trauma of the jouissance, in the sense of not knowing exactly how to manage it, how to handle these perceptions that are coming from the body, and that they are, that he's not unaware of them, and then he needs to put them somewhere.
Yeah, that's a problem. But that's not only the problem of little Hans, it's the problem of anyone. At the time of life of little Hans.
I didn't want to talk personally about that, but yeah.
I don't. Right. That is, there is always something in the order of jouissance that is left outside regulation, let's say. The regulation of the phallic order or any other order.
Is this a symptom? Will this be what you will call a symptom out from the fantasy?
The symptom, if we take the Borromean view of it, is in the interface between symbolic and real.
Right.
Because as symbolic, it already involves an interpretation of what is happening. What is happening to the body, what is happening in the relation with others, and so on. As a real, there is what Freud called the sexual life of the neurotic. The symptom is the sexual life of the neurotic. It's reduced to it, no? This symptom. But so there is a jouissance there as well. No? So here we have the coexistence, difficult coexistence of a jouissance and an attempt to regulate it with the fabrication of an interpretation of it, no? And that is why it doesn't work very well, because it is a pure fabrication that does not respect the real of that jouissance. Mm-hmm.
It is in this respect that you mentioned the sexual jouissance?
Interesting that Lacan, in this same chapter 20, where he discusses little Hans in seminar 16, refers of sexual jouissance as not being the only possible jouissance. There are jouissances that are not sexual. The problem with the human is that anything can be sexualized. So it can be given phallic and even non-phallic signification, but of a sexual nature, things that are not sexual per se. No.
All right. Look, we've been working hard for 2 hours now. I think we have one last question from Daphne, and then, yes, some of us have watched the sunrise, and we've been working very hard. Daphne. Can you unmute yourself? Yep, good. Sorry, Daphne, we can't hear you.
It disappeared.
Oh, no, she's there. Daphne? Can we hear her, Daphne?
She's all the time asking if you can hear.
No, we can't.
You can. I
was mute.
Yes, I'm in mute, but you can't.
You appear to be unmuted, but we can't hear you. No, still can't hear you. Good. Here we go.
Sorry, I don't know. My computer was unmuted. Okay, it's good. Sorry. Well, I'll be very quick. Mainly to say thank you. I had a lot of comments and think, but I think we can. They can all wait, and I'm sure that the themes will repeat themselves again and again and again. There are many questions to go to last for a long time. So only one comment from the discussion and from what was said about, I think, Macario's question related to, where was it? So the quote was, there is no subject of sexual jouissance. No subject of sexual jouissance. And you referred as an example to the fantasy and asked about the place of the subject. So I just wanted to comment on that as far as I understand, the object A is exactly not sexual jouissance. It's the obstacle, because Lacan writes a sexual when he speaks about the object. So I was wondering about that. And there was, I think we can leave it for next time, but the whole topic of the turntable, the phobia as a turntable, it's something we discussed in our forum for a whole year, I think. We went back and forth. And we thought, you know, there are many ways to see it. I think we're still not agreeing about what the turntable is. Is it more, will it direct what kind of neurosis or what kind of structure will evolve from the phobia? Because the phobia, Lacan took it out of the structures. That's one way of thinking about the turntable. And the other was, is it more like something that blocks, you know, that, because like for Hans, it's a solution. I think, Leonardo, you spoke about it very clearly, and also in your examples, that the phobia is a kind of solution to a profound anxiety, and then there's the fear of something very specific, of a signifier. A signifier takes the place of this jouissance that was so frightening for the subject. But then also Lacan says in the same seminar, I think it's in the same seminar, that the phobia is the guardian of the unconscious. It guards it from being absorbed into the concept of instinct because it's readable. He uses the word lisible, readable. But he says you have to go further in the unconscious, in the analysis, to perceive the structure of unconscious knowledge without subject. Which means, I think, what he's saying is that with only a phobia, it will be directly engaged with others, with the subject supposed to know, like Hans's father went to Freud. So the phobia is not enough to perceive this structure of this other. So these are two remarks. If you want to say maybe quickly something, that would be good. Either of you, Nicole or Leonardo?
Well, there is much that is of great interest in what you said, but I don't know that we have time to discuss it.
No, it'll be for next time.
Next time.
Maybe we take it up next time.
Yeah.
Well,
you have a working day before you, right? I really admire your energy.
Thank you, everyone, for participating. It's been, of course, again, another wonderful working session. It's very interesting to always meet with you all and to listen to what you're saying and to hear everybody's thoughts and ideas and questions. And, of course, we could work forever. But
when is the next time, Nicole?
The next time, I don't have the dates in front of me, but the Forum of New Zealand will be presenting last Thursday of the month. We will be sending out information, of course, in the Zoom links and so on, right, and so forth.
And we still have room for other forums to join, right?
Yes,
because
we do.
We plan to do this for a whole year and we have only until December.
That's right. So, and towards the end of December, I think we should have the discussion about who else would like to continue presenting.
Mm-hmm. It is scheduled for 27th
of August.
27th of August? Okay.
Yes. Thank you, everybody.
Thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
Good night. Bye. Thank you.
Thank you.
It was a fadiha. Yeah.